Hi, I'm Paul Barclay, and this is Big Ideas. How does the media shape public opinion about poverty and social exclusion? Can media coverage help to drive positive change? This discussion examines the impact of media representation on social cohesion and the integration of marginalised groups, as well as the use of these representations by government to push particular policy agendas. A panel of journalists and community leaders discuss tabloid journalism, the targeted leaking of political data, and freedom of opinion. Journalist and academic Helen Vatsakopoulos is talking to Joe Hildebrand, columnist with News Corp Australia and co-host of Studio 10 on Network 10. Lenore Taylor, editor of The Guardian Australia, Mahel Crayham, a researcher from the International Research Centre for Youth Futures at the University of Technology Sydney, Nancy Aguavara, journalist and senior producer at NITV, National Indigenous Television, and Owen Bennett, president of the Unemployed Workers Union. This talk is about how the media sets the agenda and is being used to direct the agenda.
First, I want to start with a big picture question. A very short answer from each of you. What is your analysis of the huge political seismic shift that's been happening in the world? The return of Pauline Hanson, Brexit, the USA election result, and the pollsters and the media getting it all wrong. Owen, what's your take?
That's a doozy. I think it's actually probably simpler than a lot of people think. I think it boils down to the fact that the official neoliberal narrative has failed, and a lot of people are searching for answers. People just don't buy that neoliberal stuff anymore, where you can just go out and get a job, you know, that society is inherently fair and trickle-down economics is the answer to growing the economy and to providing people that sustenance they need to survive. You know, if you're poor, it's your fault. That's the assumption from all that when you strip away all the layers. And I think people, as I said, don't buy it anymore. And there's a huge vacuum there that people want to fill, a counter-narrative. And the counter-narrative that's becoming so popular now in America and also in Australia is a xenophobic idea where you blame the outsider for the problem. And I think what we need to do, and I know this is, I'm skipping a few steps here, but we need to put the spotlight right back on the government. The neoliberal narrative is the problem.
Okay, we'll tackle that later. Lenore.
So my view of it is similar, but I'd express it in a slightly different way. That people are feeling left behind, disenfranchised. That's because they have been. Income inequality is increasing. Wages are stagnating. The political system isn't actually addressing those questions in the way that obviously large parts of the electorate think that it should be. In response to that, there are sort of competing narratives. The one that makes sense to me is the best way to make people not feel left behind is for them not to be left behind, to have a decent living wage, to have decent unemployment benefits, to have a decent health system. The other narrative is to look at groups that might be scapegoated either by those people or by people trying to analyse what's going on and say it's about, you know, political correctness because those people are actually concerned about asylum seekers or whatever else. I think it makes far better sense to address the root cause of the problem. I think the one thing we know for sure is that people are getting quite fed up with the status quo of politics. It's why you've seen, on the one hand, people like Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders gain popularity, and on the other hand, many politicians from the far right. I think it's a battle of ideas, and for my money, we're better to address the root cause of why people are feeling left behind.
Joe.
Yeah, I think they're both good points. My sense is there's just a massive disconnect. I sense that the traditional left and right spectrum is actually fragmenting, and we're looking more at a sort of a quadrant thing where you've got this weird, like Donald Trump, for example, is this weird amalgam of old school nationalistic, isolationist, protectionist politics married to what would be considered quite right-wing cultural values. So, you know, Donald Trump looks nothing like a Republican is meant to look. You know, he hates free trade. He's pro-social security and increasing and protecting social security. All these things are anathema to Republicans. So, in a sense, you've seen I suppose, the far left and the far right kind of come together. And I wouldn't be the first person to observe that Donald Trump, in many ways, has far more in common with Bernie Sanders than he does with the mainstream Republican movement, or indeed probably that Bernie Sanders has with, you know, what you might call the real Hillary Clinton before she suddenly became Bernie Sanders. So there's that. And given we're talking about media here today, I think, you know, I'd actually question whether or not this sort of mythical media monolith that drives public opinion and tells us all what to think actually exists anymore, if indeed it ever did. I think there might have been a case for it when everyone watched a 6 o'clock news each evening or bought one of two or three newspapers in the morning, but we know that's simply not happening anymore, and the media is becoming an echo chamber at best. So people are going to media outlets that already align with their values and their views, and then they're getting those views reinforced back to them. And then there have been some claims, particularly in light of Trump, where media is so open source, if you like, that stories are being fabricated and simply made up just to suit someone's political agendas. And that seems to be an equal opportunity defamer. So it's had this massive disrupting effect in the US politics. But it all just comes down to the fact, ultimately, that there is a disconnect between the conventional establishment that you would probably consider to be economically liberal but socially progressive, if you like. So basically a lot of affluent people who hold really progressive values, have no problem with, you know, asylum seekers, you know, Indigenous rights, gay marriage, people a lot like us, probably, and people on the ground who are struggling, who are suffering financially, who may not have received a particularly good education, and thank you very much for that, government. And so when they do have problems, they look for the easiest person to blame.
Okay, Nancy, what do you think? There's been quite a bit of scapegoating happening, hasn't there?
Yeah, I have to agree with all of that. There's been a lot of change, I think, in the world, globalism, rise of corporate culture and drive for profits, which has led to, you know, a lack of resources and displacement of people across the world, and there's less embracement of diversity as we've had to come together, and that's meant a disparity between, I think, the haves and the have-nots, and underemployment, as Lenore said, and slow wage increases in Australia, and I think it's a reaction to that.
Trump, Brexit, the rebirth of Pauline Hanson or whatever it is, are kind of all symptomatic of something that has been happening for a really long time. I think it's not that politics has necessarily changed. I think that we're just more comfortable in being overt with our lack of political correctness. And I think, in part, I think the way that, you know, there has been a lot of scapegoating going on, and I think that the way that media deals with certain issues in often very non-nuanced ways adds to the way that the general public, like, because there are lots of people who aren't going to go and do their own research on certain issues and who don't think that they need to go and do any research on certain issues. And so I think when the only thing you're hearing is a very two-dimensional story about whether it's refugees or asylum seekers or, you know, whatever else that it is that you should be afraid of today, then I think it's very easy to feel like you need to do something, and the thing that you need to do is align yourself with a movement that is quite conservative, that is quite nationalist, I guess, in a sense, to give yourself some sense of authority, some power again, a way of being able to express yourself and for your concerns to be taken seriously. And so even though I think that things like unemployment are certainly issues that we need to address as a nation, I think that race plays a really important factor in the way that these things have played out. And I think to deny that racism is a factor in these things is to pretend that it's not there. And I think that that's quite an unfair thing for the people who are on the receiving end of that racism.
So, Joe, I agree. When we're talking about the media, it's not a monolithic structure anymore. Yes. So curated media, where we're reinforcing things that we like and we know aside, and fake news aside, if we look at the sort of traditional respected media, it still plays a role in certain portrayals of minorities and people who are looking for paid work. So let's have a look at an example now. The headline is "Parental Welfare Pays More Than Work." So this is an article from October the 28th, 2016, The Australian, front page, by Sarah Martin. So Social Services Minister Christian Porter says new data showed that taxpayer-funded benefits could be providing a disincentive to work. And this was using selective data. Oh, and I'll get you to talk about this.
It's kind of satisfying in a way that the government has come out, you know, just in a strange way, and come out and said it, because this is what they always think. the dull bludger myth. This is what this is saying. It's saying that people on Newstart, people on Social Security, are actually better off than people in work. This is the dull bludger myth. So it's nice to have it out in the open so we can just tear it to shreds.
Sorry, can I just check? This is people. This is for parents, though, isn't it? This isn't for people on the dole.
That's right. But the wider idea that people on Social Security, but there's a lot of people on single parent pension also have to meet the same requirements of being on the dole. They have to attend their job agencies. And it's only about $200 extra a fortnight. So there's a lot of similarities between the two payments. Well, when the youngest child turns six, they have to meet a lot of requirements with their job agency. And we've had calls, the Unemployed Workers Union, of people on the single parent pension actually being forced to do work for the dole when the youngest child is six. So they do overlap a lot. But yeah, I take your point. But let's just look at the case of what Porter said. He said that you earn more on the single parent pension with all those the family payments, which they actually want to get rid of, which I guess it's kind of why they put the article in there. They want to get rid of these family payments, so they're saying, you know, it's too generous. But I mean, it's been commented on a lot. I'm sure a lot of people have already seen this, that he was comparing someone with four kids and had all those payments with someone who didn't, who was on minimum wage. So if that same person with four kids was also on minimum wage, they would have far more money, obviously, because they would still be collecting the...
Was it, I think it was the average wage, wasn't it?
Yeah, the average wage. Yeah, median wage, sorry. Yeah, median wage. So it's clearly false, but it's satisfying to rip it to shreds and to show this dole bludging myth and expose it. And it does go beyond just people on Newstart, I believe.
It's false, or it is a selective reading of data? It's comparing apples and oranges.
It's a false comparison.
Yeah, my understanding of it is that this data was basically saying these are all the tax breaks you get if you're earning $80,000 a year, which I think was the median wage or the average wage that they picked, and that a person actually getting a job would end up paying that much in tax. So they'd actually be ahead by not getting a job. And what they'd failed to take into account, according to a former Department of Social Security number cruncher, I think, who appeared in the Fairfax Press the next day, was that you actually get tax benefits. You would get that many tax benefits on $80,000 a year that, in fact, you would be ahead. So it applied the tax, the welfare relief, but not the tax relief once you got the job.
Okay. Lenore, how does this happen? You've worked in Canberra for a long, long time. How does this process actually move
well, just
from...
Just to be clear, it's a false comparison because it's taking a single parent with four kids of specific ages, which is actually a 2.5% of families, and comparing them to a worker without taking into account that that worker would also get the family benefit. It is a classic false comparison, like an inaccurate comparison.
You know, if you're a day-to-day journalist working in the press gallery, I mean, you know, sure, if you're four corners, you might get all this data and be able to unpack it in 8 weeks before you go to air or whatever, or maybe they can do that at The Guardian as well. But it's pretty hard. If you're being presented with stuff, say, right, this is the official departmental data, you know, and you're working on a Sunday for a Monday story, it's very difficult to actually...
It's not that hard. I mean, is it seriously, it's really not that hard.
Okay. Joe, I just want to ask you, if this information came to you and News Corp said, Joe, we want you to write something about this and these people who prefer to be on the dole, what would you do? I mean, you're saying that, okay, we all know that the media is moving faster and faster and faster, the 24-hour news, you've got less and less time to check. Mm. You'd check this, wouldn't you?
Look, if I thought it smelled fishy, obviously I would. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of times when I've been given, you know, stuff from the government via a department. If you're assured that, you know, those are, like, it took a former expert on tax who worked in the Department of Social Security to actually unpack all those figures. And I think it was Peter Martin from Fairfax who wrote.
So now
he's a you know, an economics correspondent. So he's
Greg Jericho had a pretty good go at it as well.
But anyway,
you just call up someone at the Welfare Rights Network and say, "Does this sound right to you?" It'll be one phone call. That's all it would take.
Yeah, like if it was, you know, she may have made 10 phone calls and no one picked up the phone. She may have not had found anyone who could do it on that day. So, you know, and she may have been assured. You know, the minister's office, even during the quote in the Fairfax piece, was still swearing by the figures.
Let's just go to the second example. So so this is a quarter of all dole recipients are shirking appointments and jobs. Owen.
It's the same thing again. The classic technique, you lead with a headline, which is completely outrageous, and then you have a stat that's been selected completely out of context, and then you have a minister that backs it up at the end and says, yes, this is totally true. And then you walk away from that thinking, well, that must be true because all those people are talking about it. But this particular instance, what they've done is they took all the data of people who have missed their appointments with their job agency. So in this instance, it was about 270,000 people in a quarter who didn't attend their job agency and got penalised for that, which is a whole other issue about the skyrocketing rates of suspensions and penalties. So that wasn't mentioned in the article, that the actual, just as an aside, the amount of penalties inflicted on unemployed workers has tripled in the last 3 years. That hasn't been talked about. Instead, they use this as an example of saying, well, they're obviously doing the wrong thing because they're getting penalised. There's no actual, you know, investigation about what's happening with those penalties. But back to the story, they're presenting the failure of attending their job agency appointments and getting suspended for that as if that's them not wanting work. As it says in the title there, as shirking jobs. Yes. When there's not one of those people who actually had a job interview, there's no indication that any of those people had a job interview. What they were getting penalised for was not attending their job agency appointment, which is an entirely different thing.
But that's what it says in the headline, though. It says, yeah, shirking appointments and jobs.
And jobs, yeah. And actually, the initial headline that ran in the Daily Telly is different to that one. The initial headline was, Dole Shirkers Shun Work. That was the initial headline when the telly ran it. And that's what screamed from the headline. And people go, oh, bloody Dole Bludgers. At it again, you know. And the data is just so completely different. Like, anyone who has any idea of Centrelink system can look at the amount of people who are actually getting penalised for refusing work. And I did a reading on this, and in the financial year 2015, there was 1,400 penalties were applied for refusal of work. That's a whole year. That's just what, that's 1,400 people for a whole year. And of those people, only 378 were served because the other ones, they had a reasonable excuse not to accept that work because there is a very important right that unemployed workers have to reject work that is unsuitable for them because of their various conditions and personal barriers, etc. So you've got 250,000 people who are rejecting jobs on the one hand, that's the News Corp position, and then the reality, it's actually 378 over a year, and that was over 3 months. So if you extrapolate what they're saying, they're actually saying it's 1 million people per year, 250,000 for every quarter. That's 1 million people who are apparently rejecting jobs because there's jobs everywhere if they just go out and get one, stop being so lazy. But so, the actual data is 378 per year of people who have rejected jobs.
So, Lenore, how does this happen? Are journalists not numerate anymore?
I don't know that I'd want to answer for the entire journalistic class. I did look, when I was still political editor of The Guardian, I did look into this story and another story that wrote at that time, that was written at that time. One thing that came out was that that data came from a point in time when people were moving from one system to another in the job network. And so there probably were inadvertent breaches at a higher level than normal. There was another story around about the same time titled Booze, Drugs, Dole Rot, Dole Grubs, Shirking Work, which claimed that tens of thousands of bludgers were using a medical scam claiming illnesses, including drug and alcohol abuse, to get the dole without having to find a job. When I prosecuted that a bit, the Minister's office was happy to tell me that, in fact, they were concerned only about the level of people using medical excuses in some very isolated areas where the percentages were up to around 55%. But they were happy to concede that nationwide, the overall level of medical exemptions was only around 7 or 8%, which is the normal historical average. And when you've got people moving, sort of who used to be on disability pension, who have some sort of episodic illness, that's not at all surprising. So when I came back after Booze, Drugs, Dole Rot, Dole Grubs, Shirking Work and prosecuted the figures, they were more than happy to present and lay out the actual picture so that I could write a story in The Guardian, but they'd already got the headline that presumably they wanted from the first iteration.
I'd like to just say something there because there was a similar thing that ran with Alan Tudge recently where he was laying the case for more penalties, essentially giving job agencies the unprecedented power to fine unemployed workers for a whole range of things. So this sort of apparent shirking doesn't happen anymore. And there was all sorts of figures that he put forward. Like, for example, one of the main ones, the headline figure, was 400,000 unemployed workers don't have to meet their mutual obligations or do not have any mutual obligations. And then I, because I write every now and then for the New Matilda, and I called up and said, where do you get this figure from? And I don't have the clout of Lenore, but I tried to get to the bottom of it. And I said, well, where is this 400,000? Because in the job seeker compliance data, which is publicly available, it only says there's 105,000 people who have who are exempt because of their sickness or various other reasons. But then they wheel Tudge out and he says 400,000, which is half. So okay. I tried to get to the bottom of it with the department, and I said, you know, and they were very helpful on the phone. I said, well, can you please send through where you got that figure from? You know, nothing. I called again. Nothing. Can you please send it through? Nothing again. And then I just didn't know what to do in that situation where he can just make up a figure, it seems like, and there's no accountability.
Yeah. Well, the headlines are written. The stories are written. Mm. It's out there. The damage is done. Mud sticks. You can't remove it. Joe, you're not the representative, I know, of sure. News Corp here, but you do work there.
Yep.
How is it that these cheap headlines manage to get published and then there's no comeback?
Well, the whole point of a headline is to get attention. So, you know, headlines by their very nature are short and sharp, often provocative. The whole idea is they're meant to get you to read the story, and then hopefully the story is correct and that way nobody gets hurt. You know,
yeah, but they're done for shock value.
Well, yeah, I mean, headlines are meant to be.
Look, people win Walkleys for headlines, so they really should get it right.
The whole point of a headline is that they're accurate, that they're punchy. The whole point of a headline, particularly in a tabloid newspaper, is that it wants to get people's attention and it wants to get people to read the story.
Okay, and then
yes,
the story,
of course, should be accurate.
But the story itself sometimes selective, big punch to support the headlines.
I suppose
and
all news stories are selective.
The damage.
All news stories are selective to a point, because otherwise they would all be infinitely long.
But News Corps are more selective than some others?
Well, I think everyone thinks that, you know, their own preferred media outlet is the objective one and that the others are the biased one. I think, you know, bias is in the eye of the beholder.
What do you think about some of these stories that have come from News Corp as an employee?
I think they're all perfectly accurate. I'm not entirely across all the data, but I do know from being a journalist for a long time, you can comb through any data you want and pull out pretty much any angle you want. You can pull out a left angle, a right angle.
Yeah, but what about social responsibility in terms of got to get it right? These are people's lives we're dealing with, and the less fortunate people in our
depending
society.
Depending on your, I suppose, ideological position, your idea of the socially responsible, what's the socially responsible thing to do is going to be different. You know, there's a whole portion of the community. Like a conservative, for example, would say, you know, an arch conservative would say, well, there should be no welfare whatsoever. No one should be getting anything. Now, obviously, you know, I don't agree with that view at all, and most sensible people wouldn't. There are other people who said, well, there's too much. There are other people who would think that it is a far more important priority to get the budget back in the black, and if that requires some pain, if people have to suffer, well, so be it. There's a whole bunch of people, and there's a narrative being put around at the moment, and this is what was interesting about the other piece on the hypothetical single mum of four. There's a narrative being put around that, you know, almost half of people, even when they're working, receive more money in benefits than they actually pay in tax. And Scott Morrison has been putting this around now as though it's a terrible, terrible thing. Now, the disproving, I suppose, of the Australians, or the response to the Australian piece that shows, oh, no, but even if she's earning $80,000 a year, she's still getting all these benefits. That actually feeds into the conservative narrative. So even while you might have sort of won the battle against that particular article, you're almost losing the war. So the Conservatives would look at that and go, oh, my God, so even when they're on the average wage, they're still not paying anything?
Yes.
So, and again, that's just an example of how you can pull apart those facts and those stats to make whatever point you want. Like, I thought Owen's response in the New Matilda to the other piece we were talking about the unemployment thing, I thought that was really good, but I noticed that you compared the amount of money spent on unemployment benefits, the $10 billion or whatever, you compared that to GDP. Now, some people would say that that's a false comparison because it's actually a proportion of government revenue and spending. It's not a proportion of GDP, which is the amount of money circulating through the economy. Now, I can understand why he did it, because he wanted to make a point that this was a small amount of money. But again, it's using numbers to perpetuate an argument that you're already...
Well, the difference there is there's a fact at the bottom of it, which is we don't spend much on unemployment benefit. It's less than 1% of even the total
of GDP.
Social Security
spending. Right.
Oh, no, not just GDP, but Social Security spending. It's so small. It's only $11 billion of a total of the number escapes me, but it's a very small percentage of the total social security spending.
More than one. Just someone who is obsessed with getting the budget back in the black will say, well, we've got a budget deficit of $40 billion. If we knock that off, we could pay off a quarter of that. Now, that's not my position.
This is Big Ideas on RN and online. Joe Hildebrand, Lenore Taylor, Mahel Kraham, Nancy Aguevara and Owen Bennett are in conversation with Helen Vatsakopoulos. They're looking at how the media portrays marginalised groups and how they can shape social cohesion for better or worse.
I want to move on to representation of Muslims in our society. Now, Mahel, in tough economic times, scapegoating takes place. What do you think is the dominant Arab-Australian narrative at the moment in the press?
Firstly, I think that if we're talking specifically about Arabs, I think we're very confused about who Arabs are and what groups comprise the Arab population. I think right now, because we're very obsessed, I suppose, with Islam and Muslims, our idea is that an Arab has to be Muslim, and particularly in, you know, public discourse and certainly in media discourse, the way that certain things are talked about are often, sometimes perhaps accidental, but a conflation of the two categories. And so I think the way that we see Arabs right now is as, if not terrorists, then potential terrorists. And I think the more overtly Arab they are, the more likely they are to be terrorists is the way that we see them. And I think if you look at it, the examples over the last few years, if you look at the demonization of Arabic as a language over the last few years, there was, you know, those billboards, the Optus ads, I think it was, that were in Arabic in areas where there were high levels of Arab Australians. You know, there was a huge fuss about that and equating that with support of terrorism and whatnot, and those signs had to be taken down. And then you see more comical things, which is someone has like a tote bag, I was going around social media the other day, with something written in Arabic, but it was basically something along the lines of, you'll be scared because you're reading this in Arabic, or something to that effect, and it was supposed to be like a humorous take on that. But so basically I think right now we just think that Arabs are terrorists.
We've got some choice front pages of the Daily Telegraph. Prepare yourself, Joe. Bankstown beheaders. Okay, here we have Bankstown beheaders, radical teens carrying bayonets for slaughter. Here's another one, the unwise mufti. Okay, sees no problem, hears no concerns, and guess what? Speaks no English. Okay, and terror vision, which of course is the ABC. So take us. We haven't mentioned the Daily Terror, but so Mahel, take us through some of those, and what does that actually feel like as an Arab Muslim Australian?
It's really upsetting, if nothing else. So on an emotional level, it's an extremely upsetting thing to see. On a kind of intellectual level, it's infuriating and absolutely just unacceptable. If you look at particularly the headline, the unwise mufti, the fact that in this day and age, at a time where we think we're really progressive and we're really into exploring different viewpoints and you know, looking at the way others see the world, and we think of ourselves as progressive, for want of a better term, to have a headline and an image where you can compare someone to a monkey, and people think that that's okay to put on the front cover of a newspaper, is just completely, there are no words. I think the state that we are at as a society and how acceptable Islamophobia is and how widespread it is outlined in the front page of that particular article. And I think one of the things is this and all of those kinds of headlines give, and not just the headlines, followed by the rhetoric in these articles and the way certain issues are discussed in these articles and the lack of nuance in discussing these particular issues gives rise to for people to think that this is okay. So we don't have a Trump presidency.
It normalises it.
Yeah. We don't have a Trump presidency because, you know, for no reason. It comes from somewhere. And he didn't think, oh, maybe I'll spout anti-Muslim rhetoric. Maybe I'll say that it's really important to put Muslims on a register for no reason. He didn't pluck that out of thin air. That comes from somewhere. And like it or not, the media is often where these things start to kind of, it's fertile ground for these kinds of ideas. And Yeah, unfortunately, this is what we end up with. And that has real effects on the lives of people. So, Joe, when we were talking about social justice and you were saying that there are a whole variety of viewpoints and different people can take different things from it, that's completely ignoring the fact that there are particular power dynamics at play and there are certain groups and certain people that don't have access to the media in the same way that other more powerful groups do. And to say that, oh, well, I can make the data say this or I can make the data say that is ignoring the fact that as a society, we have a responsibility to protect more vulnerable groups in our society, and minorities, ethnic minorities, religious minorities, sexual minorities, whatever it is, have the right to be protected and to feel safe and not to have to, every time, you know, we witness an article like that, be fearful of going out into the street or be fearful of going to work because of what the kinds of questions that people are going to ask us or the, you know, I've been standing at a train station and people have thought that it's completely okay for them to come and ask me A, very personal questions or, you know, to spit at me or to harass me verbally. And those kind, they're the real effects of seeing this every single day. And I can't think of the last time that I opened a newspaper, and didn't see a story about Islam and Muslims with some kind of terrorist implication. And so I think that idea of social responsibility is really important and one that sometimes it doesn't appear journalists are taking very seriously. I'm not saying that that's the case. Maybe I'm not privy to that information. But from what I see and on the receiving end and, you know, the Muslims that I know and certainly the data from that's being collected about Islamophobic incidents, such as on the Islamophobia Register, doesn't indicate that that social responsibility is being taken seriously.
Joe, how does... Joe, how does the Daily Telegraph justify something like this?
Thanks, town beheaders.
This or the one we just saw about the Mufti?
Do you want me to talk about the Mufti?
Okay, let's talk about this one first, that you would have someone who's very, very highly regarded by a religion in this country ridiculed and compared to an ape. How does someone at News Corp actually sit down and come up with this?
Well, to put I assume everyone knows the background to this story, do they? After the Paris terrorist attacks that killed 130 people, the Mufti put out a statement in which he said, you know, it was sorry about the attacks, but we had to address the causes of terrorism, which included Islamophobia. I think foreign wars
he said
was
a
another
bit more
one.
More than just sorry and about the attacks. He
said we also have to address the causes of terrorism, which is Islamophobia and racism, and I think foreign
legitimate,
wars.
Legitimate?
Well, a lot of people felt that in a city
Who's a lot of people?
Well, a lot of
the
our
News
readers,
Corp,
I can assure you
journalists
that.
And staff.
A lot of people, and myself included. I remember it was a friend of mine in the Muslim community who showed me the statement when it first went out, and I just looked at it and went,
oh, that's that seems, one person. That's a bit like saying journalists using some people say.
I was shocked by it. I was shocked by it. This was a city where you'd just had the Charlie Hebdo massacre, where cartoonists had been killed under the accusation of Islamophobia, and then just after an atrocity even far greater, less than a year later, in the same city, it appeared to many people, and I have to say it could easily be been read like that, that he was blaming Islamophobia for those attacks. So instead of actually blaming the terrorists, he was saying, well, no, it's actually society that's caused this through Islamophobia, and implying that the attacks were
implying,
justified.
Not implying.
Well,
that's not your
been
reading,
talking
is
about
it,
a lot of, we've been
Lenore.
Talking about a lot of implications. So there was that. Now, the whole problem with that statement is the way it was worded. So going to the fact that he speaks no English, that is actually central to the point that his statement, and I was told by quite a senior person in the Muslim community, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I was told that part of the problem was that his regular translator was actually on an aeroplane when the statement needed to be put out, someone else had put out the translation. Now, in terms of the criticism for speaking no English, that came from other Muslim leaders. That criticism, one of the biggest critics was the chairman of the Parramatta Mosque. It was also on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald.
Yes, but this is completely different. Unfortunately, his translator was away and therefore there was a problem. This is actually ridiculed.
There may have been a follow-up article that mentioned that, but anyway, the idea of saying he's like a monkey, obviously it's using the trope of the three wise
monkeys.
Okay,
so how do you come up with that decision, the trope of the monkeys?
In the same way that all decisions, front pages or stories or headlines are come up with, that, you know, you decide that this is the best way to carry the message. I mean, we've had, we dressed up a bunch of politicians like the characters from Hogan's Heroes, and we were accused of calling them Nazis. You know, like the Telegraph is a cheeky, provocative tabloid newspaper. It will always do.
Is that cheeky and provocative, or is that just racist and unethical?
I think it's a genuine comment on a senior public figure.
I don't think it's for you to decide whether or not that's racist. I think it's for people who are offended by that, and rightfully so, to decide. Actually, that is offensive to the point where it is racist.
Well, I think this is the problem.
It's rooted, like, that comparing certain people to apes and monkies is rooted in a very racist history.
I don't think that's what it was doing.
But
I think,
it did. It is what it's doing.
Well, you may have that opinion. There are plenty of people.
Nancy, you probably remember when Adam Goodes was compared to an ape. So it hurts, doesn't it? Doesn't matter whether you're Aboriginal or whether you are Muslim. Is that your reading?
Well, yes. I mean, you had a very, very strong, proud Aboriginal man who was practically brought down by those comments by a young girl, and then the successive booings and hisses when he performed in his matches. And this is an elite athlete who I imagine is really quite strong and focused. And so, you know, he's left that profession now. I think that shows how these sorts of comments go right to the heart of who you are and to how you feel as an Indigenous person or a Muslim person in this country and whether you're welcomed or not. And I think we've seen a high rise in the rate of Indigenous suicides in this country. And what a lot of academics are saying is that's an accumulation of negativity that Indigenous young people face and a sense of hopelessness in those areas that leads them to take their lives so soon. I think if a history or of these kinds of portrayals of people constantly in the media and not balanced by positive images or hope for those people, well, then that's the kind of impact that it has on our communities. And I think that's a very serious impact that Australians should not be proud of, and nor should any media outlet, if you think that you're contributing towards those kinds of outcomes in our communities.
I'd have to say, I think this is completely different to
why is it what different? Happened to Adam Why is Good. It different?
Well, this is a public figure who made what a huge number of people thought, myself included, a poorly worded statement in response to an awful massacre. You know, I mean, God, I mean, look at the coverage, say, that, you know, bloody George Pell gets, you know, in the middle of, you know, all the allegations against him. He gets, you know, literally crucified, ironically.
But don't you think this is almost normalising? this is you know, normalising.
He's a senior public figure. He's a major public figure. And quite frankly, I think his response was really ill-judged and ill-worded. And, you know, whether or not I agree with the front page or agree with the sentiments is almost immaterial. I think it's a perfectly valid comment to make. And the Telegraph has gone equally hard on other public figures.
You don't really get the dehumanising aspect of it. Like, that's the point. Like, as you were saying, you know, it compares people to apes and to monkeys. It's such an overt dehumanisation of people. And that's what's been going on with dole bludgers. Like, this is the recurring theme, and I think it's a really great segment. Like, that is the recurring theme. It dehumanises people, therefore makes it easier for the general public to ignore their suffering because they're not people.
Yeah. The thing that I find quite interesting about this is that the same publication that likes to lecture everyone really about freedom of speech will go this hard at someone because his condemnation of the Paris attacks wasn't worded in exactly the way or as strongly or without any kind of rider that this publication thought he should say. So it was basically saying, you know, he didn't word his statement the way the Daily Telegraph thinks he should have worded his statement, so this is a valid response.
Well, he's allowed to word his statements however he wants, and, you know, the Telegraph is allowed to respond to it however. That's what free speech is. It was felt that he was justifying the terrorism. He was saying, well, yes, that happened, but it was because of these reasons.
Well, he didn't exactly say that. And this kind of response has such a kind of chilling effect on debate because, the Daily Telegraph has such power and can wield it in these kinds of ways.
A lot of people found it was chilling that he was, you know, seeming to justify the attacks that had taken place just days earlier. Like, the bodies were still in the streets. You know, like, this is straight away and saying, oh, but yes, you know, this is terrible.
Okay,
but look, we also have to address the causes of these things. And it appeared to a lot of people, and I have to say, I could see how it was would be interpreted that way, that he was blaming the West for the acts in Paris that killed 130 people. And that was...
No, I don't think he was saying that. But look, well, it takes me back
Islamophobia, to... Islamophobia, racism, foreign wars. What?
Okay, you work for Ten Network. Waleed Ali had a very powerful segment around about the time when government was saying, why don't these Muslims protest more? Why don't they condemn more? Mm. And he reeled them off. Here's one, here's another, here's another. How much condemnation is enough for the Daily Telegraph? Mahal, what do you think?
I don't even know what there is to say. I think that that question is exactly right. How many times do you have to condemn something before people realise that you've condemned it? And, you know, I think there's a point where if you're not listening, that's not our problem. It's not my problem if every single time something happens, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 press releases go out condemning something and you don't pay attention to that, that's not my problem. There's a point where you have to take responsibility for the information that you don't seem to be getting. Yeah, it kind of blows my mind. And the fact that someone is not allowed to actually recognise that there are causal, like, reasons or issues that need to be addressed in order to prevent something like that from happening again seems outrageous. Why is it completely okay and justified in every other discussion to talk about the root cause of a problem? But suddenly, when we're talking about terrorism, the only position that as a Muslim community we're entitled to have is one of, you know, begging for, you know, in our sorries and condemnations and begging for forgiveness and begging for acceptance. Why do we constantly have to be on our knees asking you to accept what it is that we're saying? Why is that the only valid position for us as a community?
I don't think anyone's asking the Muslim community to go on its knees at all. It'd be like, I mean, imagine if in the wake of the Royal Commission, you know, George Pellard came out and said, look, yes, we did have some priests who abused some children, but we have to look at the causes of that. You know, what about if, you know, like, I mean, there would have been an absolutely explosive response to that.
Well, we're not discussing the Catholics today, but I can see I can see the point. But, Mahal, I just want to ask you, this sort of reporting, this sort of normalisation of discussing Muslims in Australia, how do you think that then feeds into politics and the laws? So it may not be true, but it's out there, it's been read, it sticks, and then what's the next process in terms of government? We must clamp down on
everything. So everything to do with Muslims needs to be clamped down on. But I think there are specific things that right now that are obviously very heightened. So one is issues of, you know, anything terror related. And I think it becomes very easy to pass any kind of very conservative laws around, you know, taking away our basic civil liberties when people feel like there's a bigger problem at play. And that idea of, well, I don't have anything tied, so governments can do whatever they like. They can have access to whatever information they need, and they do anyway, so whatever. So there's that kind of idea that because I don't have anything tied, I shouldn't have to worry about those things. But there are real, you know, there are real consequences for that. But then the second thing that I think is also very important is, or there are three things. The second thing, I think, is the way that we treat our refugees and asylum seekers in the wake of Islamophobic rhetoric. And that idea that, you know, that those things have always been linked, that the way that the media discusses it, and there's plenty of research about that, links Islamophobic sentiment with asylum seekers and the way that we feel about asylum seekers and refugees, which makes it very easy to say, you can never come to Australia by boat, and if you do, you will literally never ever come to Australia. And then finally, you can look at things like Section 18C and the repeal of Section 18C and that idea that, well, I should be allowed to say these things. Why shouldn't I be allowed to say that? Why shouldn't I be able to publish an offensive cartoon? Why not? That's what free speech is.
If we're having a free and fair discussion, though, can we not start with the assumption that the article is untrue? I don't think anyone's actually suggested that there's anything false in the article. You might not like the presentation of it. In terms of... you know, talking about taking away our civil liberties or whatever, the whole point, is it not, is that no, only, you know, there's only a tiny proportion of the Muslim community who are radicalised, and that these crackdowns on terrorists or suspected terrorists...
I've never seen one of those headlines, front pages.
Well, no, it's mentioned in copying the Telegraph all the time, all the time. We emphasise over and over again the vast majority of Muslims are peaceful, law-abiding, wonderful people. In fact, I've actually been told off. I actually put that in a tweet when things were getting a bit heated and said, can we please keep in mind that, You know, the vast majority of Muslims are peace-loving and they condemn extremism every bit, if not more, than we do. And I was actually told off for that by Muslim activists who said, how dare you speak for us? And it's like, oh my God, I can't even tell people that Muslims are peace-loving moderates who hate extremism because I'm not a Muslim. That's where you get to if you get into the extremes of identity politics. And again, I don't think it does just take one person to say they're offended by something to therefore say, oh, that's racist. Right. Racism is in the eye of the beholder. Offence is in the eye of the beholder. And in terms of linking it to asylum seekers, the government, a conservative government under Tony Abbott, has increased the number of asylum seekers coming here specifically from Muslim countries.
I really want to move on to Aboriginal representation. Can we just put up the slide of the cartoon? Nancy, I'll get you to talk about this and how you felt when it was published.
It's really disappointing to see those kinds of images that disparage Indigenous fathers. And I understand that it's a cartoon. I think that 18C and the Racial Discrimination Act allows this. And I think that's okay because it is a cartoon and I've seen cartoons that are similarly placed towards other peoples, particularly by Bill Leake. The fact is that it's disappointing because a lot of our people found it really upsetting. The positive thing about it is that Indigenous media then took it upon themselves in the digital space to react to it with something that was good, and that was the hashtag Indigenous Dads. And I thought that was a really great way that we have been able to, with access to, particularly in this case, social media, have been able to in some ways overcome or circumvent what that has said and rebut it, what the message is in that. And so, to me, it's just a sign that the possibilities that we have now to be able to give ourselves a voice are really needed, particularly against publications like we've seen with the Daily Tally and the Mufti. We now have Indigenous TV that can attack these sort of issues and give the other side of the coin, give our feelings and expression towards those kinds of representations.
So tell me about the impact of National Indigenous Television. I mean, is it a silo that makes programs and normalises the conversation just for Aboriginal people, or do you think that its role is wider than that? And are you happy with the presentation of Aboriginal people across other networks? I mean, the ABC has been doing quite a lot. What is your take on how far we've moved, if we have at all?
Indigenous media started in the early 80s, and then it was really the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody that recommended that the government provide opportunities for Indigenous people to broadcast, and that was in 1991, but it wasn't until 2007 that we got our own television station, and I don't know if people know, but we have a huge network of Indigenous radio stations around the country that, you know, began really with the ABC because they were based in the regional and remote areas where Indigenous people needed voices. NITV's been around now since 2007. On the surface of it, I think that things have really improved as a result of NITV being on the landscape. We certainly now have an opportunity to give our side of the story, and it's really needed. I don't think it's enough, however, because, you know, what we're talking about is really, in the past we've had lots of negative stereotypes and a narrative of negativity. With NITV in the landscape now, I think that's changing. We've got more positive role models. We've got more people in soaps on commercial television, people like Deborah Malman, now Jessica Mowboy's got her own show, you know, Aaron Pedersen. And we've had great success in films like The Sapphires and Samson and Delilah. So I think things are improving. I think a disparity is there's no longer those overt stereotypes, but what I do see is invisibility, I think, in some of the issues that I think should be more important and be given more attention and shine a light on for Indigenous people, people who have experienced great injustices and in communities where things really, you know, could use, where people need to know where things are.
Across all media you're talking about, newspapers?
Yes, and I do, yes, across all media. Well, mostly in news and current affairs because that's where I work, I suppose, and where there's been injustices in perhaps we're now seeing cases where missing Aboriginal peoples weren't reported on or have been neglected by the police and the media as well, and great things that are of importance to us that just don't get that spotlight. That they should, I think.
Right? So 18C, there's going to be an inquiry into it. Are you worried about that?
I am worried about it because I feel that if what people are calling for, those groups who are, and particularly some media outlets who are advocating for the weakening of 18C, which is a part of the Racial Discrimination Act. If you weaken the Racial Discrimination Act, then, I mean, what you're doing is you're allowing more racism. That's how I see the outcomes of that.
How do you see that? Yeah. Is that going to have an impact on your community?
Well, yes, of course it will have. And I wouldn't like to see that again. I think that racist attitudes can be perpetuated through the media. It'd be best if we had more balance in that reporting so that it's a mirror to our society as well.
And Mihal, are you worried about this inquiry into 18C?
Yeah, I am. And I think most minority communities are concerned about that. I think, you know, there's a preoccupation. I think the preoccupation in discussing Section 18C is kind of to deflect from some more important issues that governments should probably be dealing with right now. But I also think that, yeah, it is, you know, like I said, if you start to normalise these kinds of things, it really takes away power and protection from people who are in vulnerable positions already. Like, those things exist to protect the vulnerable, not, you know, just for the fun of it.
This is where we have to leave today's discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it for our discussion about how the media represents the marginalised. The moderator was Helen Vatsakopoulos, journalist and academic. Joe Hildebrand, columnist with News Corp, editor of The Guardian Australia, Lenore Taylor, Mihal Krayem from the International Research Centre for Youth Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney, journalist and senior producer at NITV, Nancy Aguevara, and Owen Bennett, president of the Unemployed Workers Union. Until next time, bye for now.